The 100 Years' War, Buckingham and Brittany, 1381. Now, measures to reinforce Buckingham's army in Brittany were put in hand as soon as the king's ministers and officials had returned to Westminster. Sir Thomas Felton, the former seneschal of Gascony, was appointed to command a force of 2,000 men to sail to the Loire. He was to take with him a fleet of armed barges to close off Nantes from the river and 10,000 pounds in gold coin to be distributed amongst the men already there. Felton's expedition was not, however, the only military enterprise planned for the following months. In spite of the commons' misgivings that the fact that the funds had not been voted for, the council decided to go ahead with the expedition to Portugal. Indeed, they increased the size from 2,000, promised Juan Fernandez, to 3,000. Both of these forces were expected to leave in the spring from the ports of Plymouth and Dartmouth. The attempt to pursue both enterprises at once proved to be absolutely too ambitious. It soon became clear that Felton's army would be too late. The Earl of Buckingham had already had great difficulty in maintaining the siege of Nantes. The French garrison in the city fought off one assault after the other and began to launch sorties into the besiegers' encampments, some of which inflicted heavy losses. The English tried to undermine the walls of the city, only to find their mines destroyed by French countermines. Now Constable Olivier de Clisson and Marshal Louis Sancerre arrived in December of 1380 with fresh troops to harass the English lines from the outside and attack foraging parties that strayed too far from their bases. Supplies continued to flow into the city by river while the besiegers starved. English morale sank to new lows every day. It was a bitter cold winter. Frequent night attacks deprived the men of sleep. During December, dysentery began to spread through the army. By the beginning of January 1381, Buckingham was faced with disaster. He had lost a fifth of his men and almost all of his horses to disease, exposure, desertion, and battle casualties. On about January 6, 1381, he abandoned the siege. There was worse to come. On January 15, 1381, Jean de Montfort reached an agreement with the Council of Regency in Paris. The terms were the fruit of more than 2 months of negotiation between his representatives and a group of royal counselors led by none other than the ally of England, Erigard de Coucy. Jean de Montfort agreed to come before Charles VI to do homage for the Duchy of Brittany and obtain the king's pardon for his many acts of treachery. For this he was to pay an indemnity of 200,000 francs, about 33,000 pounds. The French government, for its part, agreed to recognize the liberties and immunities of the Duchy of Brittany as they had stood before the decree of confiscation. The towns and castles which the French still occupied would be surrendered. The great fortress, border fortress of Champs-de-Sieux on the Loire, would be restored to the Duke, although with all the domains which had been together with all the domains which had been confiscated from him in other parts of France. The treaty marked the surrender of the crown on every point of substance, but for all it was a diplomatic masterstroke. John was required to renounce all his agreements with England, to dismiss all Englishmen in his employment apart from his household officers and personal servants, and to turn his arms against his erstwhile ally and damage them in every way possible. The only qualification recorded in a secret clause was that John would not, in practice, be required to fight personally against the English. At a stroke, the foundation of England's strategy in France had been shattered. A shrewder man than the Earl of Buckingham might have guessed that such a thing was afoot when Jean de Montfort declined to lift a finger to help him during the siege of Nantes. But there's no reason to doubt the reports of the counselors and the chroniclers that he was thunderstruck when the news was brought to him. The immediate question was what to do with the English army. It was nominally the strongest armed force in France, and likely to remain so while the French government's current financial crisis persisted. But it was broken, as completely as John of Gaunt's army had been after its long march through France in 1373. For a few weeks, Richard II's council at Westminster refused to recognize the facts. They appear to have thought, what with pay in their pockets and fresh troops and horses from England, Buckingham could simply resume the siege of Nantes in the spring. They pressed on with their plans as if nothing changed. Felton's men were signed up for their indentures and received their advances. Ships began to assemble at Plymouth. Horses were procured across England and arrangements made to ship them to the Loire. In late March and early April 1381, Felton and his fellow captains were ordered to proceed to their ports for embarkation. But there were not nearly enough ships for them, let alone the army of Portugal as well. They were obliged to wait idly by the seashore for several weeks while the admiral officers tried to find more ships. The council had misjudged the mood of Buckingham's men, possibly because Buckingham himself misjudged it. At least one company, U. Cavalry's, withdrew at the beginning of February and made their way back to England. The rest waited despondently for orders. Without money, they couldn't buy food. Without horses, they couldn't even steal it. Finally, Buckingham decided to march to the seat of John's administration, Venez, and confront the Duke in person. John met him on the road. It must have been a difficult encounter. The Duke of Brittany explained that he had no choice but to strike a deal with the French. The towns and the church had adamantly opposed English alliance. Nobility were occupied in defending the frontier of the duchy. Without a deal with the French, there was no prospect of his being able to maintain himself in power. Buckingham was unimpressed. There were grand paroles between the two men, but there was nothing new that the Earl could do other than negotiate the best possible terms for his orderly departure for England. In early March, Sir Thomas Percy and William Lord Latimer agreed to a deal. They promised to withdraw peacefully in return for 50,000 francs, £8,333. 30,000 of it in prompt cash. Part of this money was spent hiring ships in the ports of southern Brittany for the army's return to England. The rest was promised by Whitson. The 2 days were passed in jousting with selected champions from the ranks of the French army, according to the elaborate procedure of the heralds, and the kind of event which Buckingham loved all his life. The results of these heroic exhibitions of strength and skill were as dismal for the English as the real war had been. In about the second week of March, the English army marched off towards Brest. Buckingham's agreement with the Duke of Brittany provoked much irritation in Westminster. On about March the 15th, 1381, the council decided to send the money collected for Buckingham's army to Brittany in advance of Felton's army. Sir John Kentwood, the steward of the Duchy of Cornwall, sailed from Dartmouth with two exchequer officials, an escort of archers, and a chest of gold at the end of March, and landed at Brest. His instructions were to find out how many troops Buckingham still had and persuade them to stay in France until their indentured service was complete in June. No money, they insisted, was to be paid to any captain who refused. At Brest, Kentwood found the Earl of Buckingham installed in the fortress and delivered the council's unplatable message. The Earl was immovable. He had given his word to the Duke of Brittany. His army was fed up. Part of it had already sailed for England in Breton ships. Shipping had been found for the rest. On April the 30th, Kentwood gave up. He paid the money over to the Earl and watched the last of the English army boarding ships in the harbor beneath the castle walls. On May the 2nd, 1381, Buckingham landed with his men at Falmouth in Cornwall. The campaign had been Buckingham's opportunity to do great deeds in the image of his dead father and brother. Its failure was to weigh on him the rest of his life. 13 years later, when he founded the College of Secular Priests, which was destined to be his principal monument, its statutes called for daily mass for the souls of those who died in the army of 1380-81. English policy was now a picture of disarray. The 2,000 troops of Felton's Army of Brittany were kept at Dartmouth for several weeks while the council considered what the heck to do with them. The possibility of shipping them to Gascony appeared to have actually been considered. Felton's men were joined on the Devon coast, course of May, by the Earl of Cambridge, and some 3,000 troops of the Army of Portugal, who milled about the town competing with them for food, shelter, and shipping space. No firm plans had been made when Gaunt, the moving spirit behind both the Portuguese and Breton projects, left for talks with the Scots on the northern march. In June, Felton's army was disbanded. As for John de Montfort, he became a loyal but unenthusiastic vassal of the King of France, protected by Charles VI's uncles and treated as a pariah by his older enemy, Olivier de Clisson, and the party at the French court who clustered around him. The English never forgave John for deserting him. His close personal connection with the English royal family, his English peerage, and his friendship with prominent figures in the English court only aggravated the sense of betrayal. Until the Anglo-Breton alliance was revived in the next generation, relations between England and the court of Brittany remained extremely cool. The government confiscated John's honor of Richmond and forfeited the profit of the handful of Englishmen who remained in his service. The English clung on to their expensive post at Brest, although events had now greatly reduced its value to them. They intrigued with Olivier de Clisson and from time to time toyed with the idea of promoting the claims of John of Blois. Even the Duchess, Joan Holland, the English king's half-sister, became the focus of new antagonism. She stayed in England in spite of John's attempt to have her return. Joan would not rejoin her husband in Brittany until late 1383, when she was dying. Medieval marriages are hard for a historian to penetrate. Convention, duty, and discretion make an opaque barrier, especially among those whose marriages were essentially political acts, like Egerard de Coucy, another French nobleman who had once been prominent at the English court and married an English princess. John found that their relationship would not bear a change of allegiance. So we've messed up poor old Duke of Buckingham. He's now back in England. But we're going to have some issues again in France. And this is going to be what's known as the Revolt of the Towns, because they're still having tax issues. Now, the sources for this: The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrault, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.